Last week, if you were here, we talked a little bit about, I read a sheet that talked about exorcism, some information about a lady in Australia, and oddly enough, there was another piece in the news just a couple of days ago. Now this time it's from France. The piece I have here is not nearly as long as the one from last week, just probably about four short paragraphs. So I want to read of this as well to kind of give you this perspective. Exorcists on call to raise French spirits amid surge in private treatment for demonic possession. Now, I find that first sentence to be very interesting. People, at least some, seem to think that there is a rise in demon possession, so now they've actually got some exorcists on call because there is a surge. That people, at least that's the claim, that there is a surge in private treatment for people who need demons removed. All right, this fella has been an exorcist since 2010. I'm not sure exactly what you do for that, whether you go to school or exactly how that works. But Jean Clément chanted out as he performed a ceremony to rid a fellow from Paris businessman of negative spirits, supposedly conjured up by a jealous rival. Now that's where the spirit comes from, a jealous rival. It almost sounds like a witch. I don't like you, so I'm going to cast a spell on you. As the chanting went on, Robert, the patient, as Mr. Clément calls him, appeared to have entered into a trance-like state. In his 50s, with purple circles below his puffy eyes so deeply indented that they looked like bruises, he said he'd been suffering from chronic insomnia and anxiety as his business goes through a bad patch. Now again, compare that to what we find in the Bible. Demonic possession, it's not somebody's business is going through a bad patch. It's not that they've got insomnia. No, the demon possession in Scripture, much, much different. He is one of the growing number of people in France who are turning to exorcists to save their careers or restore love to their troubled relationships. So if you take this and you line it up with Scripture, it's almost laughable as far as what they're talking about today when it comes to demonic possession. As he prepared for the exorcism, Mr. Clément lit candles and incense and placed them beside a crucifix and semi-precious stones on a coffee table in the man's elegant apartment. The ritual involves candles, incense, and semi-precious stones. Nearby, he laid out beeswax, nails, and a twig from a wild cherry tree, which he says will ward off some bad stuff. So it's sad that people today believe that, let alone they're paying for that kind of stuff. But there have always been hucksters around, and you find that a little bit later in the book of Acts. And that's what we've got here as far as some information about demonic possession in Acts chapter 8. But there certainly is nothing about let's get out the beeswax and let's get out the candles and let's just chant for a little while. This was the Spirit. This was the power of God. So it really is amazing to me what people, and it's because of ignorance, we'll say we believe that or we want that. We believe that that's going to be helpful to our cause and so forth. But this is apparently a growing phenomena. So if you hear about demonic possession, somebody's talking about that, you read that in the news, it's probably there because, again, it's becoming more and more common. And not a true exorcism, but people are just deceiving folks. Anything that you want to add or ask on that point before we pick up with some additional material? Ray?
Has that got anything to do with some kind of a church religion? The Gentiles or whatever you want to call them outside there.
In this particular story, the information that I had didn't relate it to any kind of church activity. It sounds like this guy 7 years ago decided to go out on his own and I'll become an exorcist. However, he was able to set up his own little business shingle and that's what he's doing. Some are certainly church related, but I don't know that we can conclude that all are. Anybody else? Okay, let's go into the book of Acts. We left off with Acts chapter 8 and verse 7. We're talking about the unclean spirits in the first part of verse 7, and we didn't get to the people who were sick. So we'll read again the full text for Acts 8, 7, and then also pick up Acts 8, 8. For from many of those that had unclean spirits, they came out crying with a loud voice, and many that were palsied and were lame were healed, and there was much joy in the city. Now, we remember who this book was written by, don't we? Who's the author of Acts? Luke. And what was Luke's job? He was a doctor. He was a physician. So if there were things taking place that involved medical conditions, you think that would be of interest to Luke? Yeah, I think so. And you see that reflected here. And not only do we have that reflected here, he talks about people who had very serious health issues. If you have palsy, if you're lame, the palsy, of course, would refer to some kind of paralyzation. That is a very serious matter. Now, somewhat technical point, Matthew as well as Mark used a form of the word which is translated palsy, But they used a non-technical form of the word, which was common with some other people as well. Luke uses the more technical term, a term which was also used by classical medical writers. So it's interesting that as you go back and you look at the actual word he used, Matthew, Mark, different word that's a form of the word, Luke uses that more specialized term, again, because of his background. As Luke describes the sicknesses, he also uses the imperfect tense. These people, it wasn't something, well, you know, I get a headache every once in a while. But the palsy, the people who were lame, this was an ongoing issue. So it was very, very serious. We've seen the word lame back in Acts chapter 3 and verse 2. Here, that word is expressed with a plural, and one source said it was a problem of an indeterminate nature. And that would be, I think, a good way to describe it. When you think about people who are lame, the first thing that comes to mind would be what? A lame person. What part of the body? All right, I think the leg might jump out there as far as the first idea, but again, it could also describe other parts of the body as well. If you think about a lame person, what would you expect as far as their role in society?
Back then, they couldn't participate.
All right, you would think limited participation. Anything else come to mind when you deal with lame people?
Someone had to assist them.
All right, he's probably going or she's going to need some kind of assistance. One other key point there with lame people. What's the other point? All right, they're probably going to be an outcast, and more than likely they're going to be poor. You would not expect a lame person to be a CEO of a company, would you? Most people wouldn't. They would say, well, you know, we want somebody that at least the way that they look, they're going to have the appearance of health. And you, like I say, that's just something that people would shake their head at, and really, he's the CEO or he's the president of that company and so forth. So when you think about these individuals, they probably would have been the underprivileged members of society, objects of charity, and you could have that in a lot of different places for a lot of different reasons. Now, when you start thinking about the descriptions, you begin then to find that the healings were true healings. It wasn't, well, I've got this back problem that you can't see, and it can't be defined, it can't be accurately examined, but he was someone who was healing some people with some very, very dramatic health issues. Well, if you have that kind of issue, not only because the gospel is coming to town, but because people are being healed, they're being healed of these, you know, the guy is paralyzed, he can't walk, his arms don't function and so forth. You don't have any other impairments listed here, but I do think it's likely when you deal with the people who were lame and the people who had paralyzation, I do think it's likely that you have some other health issues that were healed. I don't know that he was just focused on these issues, but because these problems were so serious, I think that these are just representing some other health issues. But if you have this guy who's paralyzed, you have this other guy who's lame, and you start going to town and you start healing these guys, what do you think is going to be the reaction? It's your relative. It's your son. It's your daughter who's lame. It's your grandpa who's paralyzed. It's your mom who can't walk. All right, I think impressive would be one of the things, and that would be perhaps included in the word joy. Anything else beyond impressive?
Well, they've never been able to participate.
Sure, there's going to be great joy. Grandma could never be involved with Thanksgiving Day. As far as preparation of food or getting to the table on her own, now what? Christmas dinner? Thanksgiving dinner, she's going to be able to not only participate if she wants to in preparing the meal, she's going to be able to come out and actually enjoy it as well. Don't have to wheel her out in the wheelchair anymore. Don't have to bring her out in the crutches and so forth. We made the point last time that when we think about demonic possession, that has passed away just as the other miracles have. But when we think about demonic possession, we need to make a clear distinction between that and health issues. And you have that distinction here. First part of verse 7, there were some people who were affected with demons. They were cured. You also have some people who had some health issues that is distinguished from demon possession. When you look at the first century, there were some people who got sick because of the advanced years and other choices. Sometimes it was bad decisions on their part, those kinds of things. But the Bible does make a distinction. The city, are we told where Philip went and did all this good? Are we given the city where he went?
Samaria.
Okay, but is Samaria a city or is that a region, an area?
My Bible says the city of Samaria.
Okay. But Samaria is a region. You would have had several cities there. It may have been a well-known city. We don't know exactly where Philip went, but maybe it was one of the larger cities. He does go there, and he does do a lot of good. Ray, did you have a thought? Okay. We talked about the joy that came. Luke could have used the common word for joy, and Jesus used that word in places like Matthew chapter 13, verses 20 and 24. But Philip goes a step further. Goes a step further. What kind of joy was there? Not just joy, but there was much joy. There was great joy, a lot of joy. We've talked about this before. We'll make a little bit of a pause here to discuss it a little bit more. When we think about joy, is it synonymous with happiness? Mean the same thing as happiness? Joy, happiness, identical?
No.
Joy is distinct from happiness in a couple of different ways. What's happiness determined by? Somebody says, I'm so happy today. Why are they happy? What reasons do we hear for happiness?
Things are going my way.
All right. I just got my way. I wanted to get this job. I wanted to get married. I'm now engaged. I got a new car. I got what I wanted for Christmas. I got a Black Friday deal. I'm so happy. What about the guy who didn't get the Black Friday deal? They had 100 TVs, and he was customer number 101. What do you think his attitude's going to be? Got out there at 4 o'clock in the morning. I waited all that time. I was 101. I am not happy. Well, do you think that's true?
Sure.
I think that's really true. He is not happy. He is not pleased. He's very disappointed. Maybe he's angry because he was one person shy of getting the television. Well, if there's a distinction between happiness and joy, happiness then is dependent on our
environment, situation.
Circumstances would be the third word that we could toss in there. But when we think about joy, if it's different than happiness, then one of the points that would initially come to our mind is that joy is not dependent on our circumstances.
Well, it could be an attitude problem, too, because not everybody would get mad.
That's true. Yeah, the guy might say, well, you know, they had 100 and I came a little later than I should have. Sure. And ideally, that would be the right attitude, that we lost out, maybe something else will work out okay. Did you have an extra thought there?
No.
Okay.
That's
correct. You would hope that the Christian would not be acting in that way. Let's take a look at 2 Corinthians. 2 Corinthians 7 and 2 Corinthians 8. We'll look at 2 Corinthians 7, 4, and also 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 2. Both of these passages help us a bit in understanding some things about joy. 2 Corinthians 7, 4. Who wants to take care of that one for us? All right, Steve?
Great is my boldness of speech toward you. Great is my boasting.
Okay, now at the end of the verse, he uses what word? There is what in my life? Tribulation in my life. But even though he says there is tribulation, and it's not just I missed out on getting the TV, there are great problems, there are significant circumstances which are difficult. I'm having a hard time. And yet Paul says, in spite of that, what do I have?
Joy.
All right, so 2 Corinthians 7, verse 4, shows us that joy is independent of circumstances. And then let's skip over one chapter. Let's take a look at 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 2. Here we read about some people who were poor. 2 Corinthians 8, second verse. Who's got it? All right, Dolores?
They have suffered a great deal, but their joy was more than full. Even though they were very poor, they gave very freely.
Okay. Suffered, very poor, poverty stricken, we might say. And yet, even though very, very poor, didn't have the things that certainly they wanted, and maybe in some cases they struggled with some needs, what do they still have?
An abundance of joy.
So there again, when you think about joy, it's definitely separate from happiness. Now, could joy and happiness go together? Sure. And ideally, people will have that as well. But even if you don't have happiness, you can still have joy. For the Christian, we've got joy in the past, sins have been forgiven. Joy in the present, you have that ongoing fellowship with God. Joy related to the future as far as the eternal inheritance. Now, one of the things that biblical writers do, of course, is use various words. And one of the things that people have done over the years is to take those words and to see how they were used by non-biblical writers at different periods. How were those same words used before the Bible was written? How were those same words used during the time the Bible was being written, first century? And how were those words used after the Bible was written? And there are some things that you can pull from that information, some things that you don't want to pull from that information. But one of the interesting things to me is that that word which is translated joy is rare when you look at secular writers. Now let that sink in for a minute. That word which is translated joy in the New Testament, it is rarely found in secular writings. When it is found, it's applied to things like a traveler returning to his homeland. Anybody ever been out of the country and you come back to the U.S., you've been maybe to a third world country? Anybody ever have that experience? Okay, one, two. How'd you feel when you got back?
Glad to be home.
Yeah. I am thankful that I'm back on American soil. Or maybe you've had a bad trip as far as the hotel. Anybody ever have the experience where you said, I'm glad that I'm back in my own bed? Boy, that was a flea bag that we stayed in as far as the motel, and I am thankful to be back home. Or you stayed somewhere else, which was somehow undesirable. Ray, you probably had that experience on a submarine, didn't you? You know, you're...
It was also undesirable many times.
So there can be different circumstances. You are so pleased to be home. But again, this word was very, very rare. It was applied to a traveler getting back to his homeland, the fervor in spreading false news, good floods from the Nile River. So a few times it was used, but still you almost are kind of there in the happiness category. But this is something which is almost exclusively applied to Christianity, the word joy. And that's something that we should talk about, that's something that we should hold on to, that's something that we should communicate to others. You can have joy, even in the worst of circumstances. Somebody comes along and says, I don't have anything to live for. Well, now wait a minute. If you are a non-Christian and you're telling me that, what's my message to you? I don't have anything to live for. What's my message to you as a non-Christian?
Find God.
Yes, there is something. You know, you may not have it right this second, but this is easy to access. There is the Christian life. There is joy associated. Somebody says, well, that's not going to wipe away all my problems. What would you say? Would you agree with them or not?
I would agree.
All right, we say, yes. Remember 2 Corinthians chapter 8? It's not going to wipe away every problem. But what does it do? It's associated with hope. It is associated with making you feel better. This is something that's tangible. This is something that you can hold on to. It is good news. And that's what you see in Acts chapter 8, verses 7 and 8. The people who were sick, there was much joy in the city, in part because people were healed, in part because the gospel was being preached. One source gave this outline of Philip's sermon. He said the people were numerous. They were described as a multitude. He says they were afflicted. They had different diseases. Some were demon-possessed. They were deluded. That was by the false teaching of Simon. And then they were eager with one accord, giving heed to Philip. Anything that you want to add or ask over Acts chapter 8, 7 and 8? Okay, let's move down a little bit and look at Acts chapter 8, verses 9 and 10. But notice the contrast. There's much joy in the city. People are being healed. Demonics are being healed. But there was a certain man, Simon by name, who before time in the city used sorcery and amazed the people of Samaria, giving out that himself was someone great, to whom they all gave heed from the least to the greatest, saying, this man is that power of God which is called great. Again, we have this unnamed city in Samaria, Acts chapter 8, verses 5 and 8. So Philip goes there, and he encounters someone by the name of Simon. Now, as you look at the New Testament, you sometimes have more than one person bearing the same name. That's true when it comes to Simon. If you were to look up Simon in the New Testament, you would find that there are 10 different guys by the name of Simon. Now, this one, of course, is not difficult to distinguish, to separate from the other Simons in the New Testament. And this Simon, as you go back and you look at him, you find that there are some interesting traditions about this guy outside or separate from the Bible, especially when it comes to his interaction with Peter and John, and that'll be down a little bit later in verse 14. When you look at this Simon, the text says he had before time. That's an imperfect tense verb. So this is continuous action in the past. Prior to this time, what had he practiced? He had practiced magic. Some translations will say sorcery. It's been claimed, and again, I don't put any stock in these claims, but this is some of the stuff that you can find if you look into this Simon. It's been claimed, number one, that he founded the Gnostic heresies. Anybody remember what the Gnostic heresies were? Gnostic? Knowledge? The Gnostics were people who claimed that they had secret knowledge. And if you would come to them, if you would pay them, they would let you have their secret knowledge. They'd let you be part of their organization or group. Second point that's claimed about him is that he later goes to Rome and perverted Christian doctrine. And later he became involved with Peter in a miracle contest and lost. I'm going to give some more information about that in a bit. When you look at some of the ancient stories, and again, I believe that they are utterly false, there are claims about Peter following Simon from place to place and countering his false sorceries, his bad magic, if you will, and instructing the people. Again, I don't think that there's any evidence of that, but there are some people who claim that. And then as you go back and you start looking at Simon and some of the claims, you find some even wilder tales. One source says in the legend, Simon is represented as constantly opposing Peter, who ultimately discredits and vanquishes him. In one of the alleged contests, Simon allegedly tried to fly to prove a supernatural power. Now, I think that is just way off the map, but anyway, that's what it says. Simon allegedly tried to fly to prove a supernatural power. Due to Peter's prayers, Simon fell and sustained a fracture to his thigh and ankle bones. This experience brought much vexation to him, so he committed suicide. So, as I say, people, when they start looking at Bible events, they sometimes want to jazz things up a little bit, and that's what they have done in this case. Now, I do not doubt from what's said in Acts chapter 8 that Simon was probably a very colorful character, and maybe there was some magnetism. He was somewhat charming. When you look at Luke and what he says Simon was able to amaze, or he was able to bewitch the people of Samaria, and that amazement is described with the present tense. It's not something that he had some good tricks and that was it. You may talk to a magician or see a magician, he's got some good tricks, and he says, I've shown you all my tricks, I don't have any more. That was not true for this fella. When you look at the word amaze in the New Testament, it has three different senses here, and this is going to be true for verse 11 as well as Luke chapter 24 and verse 22. The word describes amazement at the supernatural. So his quote-unquote supernatural acts, they may have been nothing more than deception, but still the people were amazed. And then you got this same term used a couple verses later, Acts chapter 8 and verse 13, and there the meaning is astonishment at the revelation of divine glory. So we'll come back to some of the stuff that he was doing and talk about whether or not it was real or whether it was fake in a little bit. But I want to switch gears for a bit. Let's talk about Simon and the claims of personal greatness for a bit. He claimed to be important. As you look at the end of verse 9, how did he make himself out to be? He said, I am the great one. And Luke uses, again, the present tense. So this isn't something that Simon said on an occasion or two, but he's telling people on an ongoing, on a regular basis that I am great. Now, if you have somebody making that kind of claim, that almost, if it doesn't, it almost reaches what kind of level? I'm great. I'm really great. I am the greatest.
Arrogance.
Well, okay. I think you can even go further with it than that. But arrogance would be one thing. What else? Well, I think that's true too. But almost, what level do you finally reach? I'm great, I'm great, I'm great, I'm really great. Almost the level of
Jesus.
Almost the level of deity. God, Jesus. And that, of course, would be a problem. One source said he was almost making the claim, or was making the claim, he was something like a spark of God himself. I'll give you this quote too. Simon's claim meant that God had many attributes and powers. One of these powers was singled out as par excellence, and Simon was supposed to be the incarnation of this power of God. Now let that sink in. I am the incarnation of the power of God. That sounds a little or a lot like who? Yeah, Jesus. So again, if you are preaching the gospel and there's somebody in your area who's making this type of claim, he's certainly going to get your attention. Simon's claims were very indeed godlike or close to impersonating God. And when you look at that word, which is translated great, it means an extraordinary person in world history or salvation history. So he is putting himself right up there on the same level as Jesus. Another source said this man claimed to be the representative of God. He may have even regarded himself as the forerunner of the Messiah. And then you have, remember how we began? We read that reading, but, and that offers a pretty good contrast to Simon, what he was doing. In contrast to Simon, his claims and his behavior, what's Philip doing? As you look at Acts chapter 8, verses 12 and 16, let's see what we find. Yeah, and he's doing what in whose name?
God's name.
Well, or the name of Christ. In the name of Jesus. So you have Philip acting in the name of Jesus, doing those things as far as baptizing, teaching, healing in the name of Christ, Acts 8, verses 12 and 16, and then you have this other fellow. When you begin to make some comparisons, and you can kind of read through the verses, I could have put up the board, I guess, but Simon worked quote-unquote miracles. That's in verse 11. And then as you look at Philip, did he do the same? Did he work signs, offer signs? He did, verses 6 and 13. Did Simon draw crowds? Yes, he did, and we know that from verses 9 to 10. Did Philip also draw crowds? Yes, he did. And we know that from verses 6 and 7. Did people heed, quote-unquote, Simon?
Yes.
Verses 10 and 11, yes, they did. Did they heed Philip?
Yeah.
Verse 6. All right, was Simon looked upon as someone who had great power? Yes, verse 10. Was that also true of Philip?
Yes.
Verse 13, yes. Did Simon amaze the people?
Yes.
Yes, verses 9 and 11. Did Philip amaze the people?
Yes.
Yes, verse 13. So, one of the practical lessons from that is, and even for today's day and time, you might find people who are saying some of the same things. You might find people who at least appear to be doing the same things. But even though they may say some of the same things, and even though they may appear to do some of the same things, are they the same? No. So here you have someone who is, in some respects, counterfeiting some things associated with the gospel, but he is certainly not a teacher. He is not a purveyor of truth. Anything you want to add or ask?
In verse 13, it mentions that even Simon was amazed by Philip.
Yeah. Yeah. When the counterfeiter is able to encounter real power. In fact, what's he say a little bit later? He offers him what? Money.
Oh, yeah.
So he can get what in return? I want the power you've got. You know, I've seen my little bag of tricks, and when I look at what you have, that's a whole lot better. So here's some money. I want to buy the Holy Spirit. So yes, when error confronts truth, when the counterfeit confronts what is actually true power, yes, there's a clear distinction. Anybody else?
Simon was doing it for his own glory. It says it built in the name of Jesus.
Yeah, I think you have to make that point as well, Stephen. That's a great thought, that Simon is out for himself. No indication that he's out there for money, but, I mean, he's not out there apparently just a showboat. So he does like the glory, but likely he's also being paid for that. And it's all about me. But Philip, there's nothing about, hey, look, I'm great. I'm the spark of God. Nothing about that. It's, I want to serve God. That's why I'm preaching. That's why I'm teaching. I want you to be saved. Let's make sure that you are baptized if you have done the other thing. So, that it? Okay, let's turn our attention to what you might be thinking about, but maybe haven't raised yet. Were Simon's signs true or were they false? I don't know that we can answer that definitively. I'm more inclined to believe that he was on the deception end of the stick. Maybe he was using some satanic power. Maybe he was involved with the occult. I do want to go back and look at some references with you as far as what I would just overall refer to as the occult. Let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 18, verse 9, and we'll go down through verse 12. We'll start there. And then also head somebody over to the book of Isaiah, Isaiah chapter 47. Deuteronomy chapter 18 is where we start. Who wants to get that for us? All right, that'll be Jeff. Isaiah 47, who wants to be lined up for that in a little bit? Isaiah 47. All right, Steve. Let's go back first of all to Deuteronomy chapter 18, verses 9 to 12. 9 to 12.
Abominations, the Lord thy God doth drive them out from before thee.
Okay. A couple points there. Number one, God used the word abomination how many times? Two. Sort of starts it with, this is an abomination, and sort of ends it with, this is an abomination. Now, when God says this is an abomination, should that get our attention? Yeah, especially when you have just a few verses, we have that word being used twice. Now, he does give kind of a list there. You've got divination, and you've got enchanters, and you've got the witches and so forth, a number of different items that would be associated with the occult. But the second point there is that God says it's not just an abomination. But what did God say about these people? What have I done to the land? I've cast the people out. Why? Because they've got these kinds of folks where? In the land. Now, if God is casting out a nation of people because they're involved with witchcraft and they're involved with the occult, just to sum that up, divination and so forth, that should get our attention. Now, there are some reasons, I think, that God was so unhappy about that. And you see it from Deuteronomy chapter 18. You also see it reflected in Acts chapter 8. Why would God be so upset with the occult kind of stuff? I mean, it seems like this really agitates him. Why?
It's deceiving others.
Well, okay, deception. He's never been enthused about that. So that would be one reason. Anything else?
Following Simon instead of Philip?
Yeah, that puts us on the right road, but let's see if we can add a little bit to it. What are we?
Humans.
We're human beings. What does God intend for us to be in this life? Human beings, right? But when you start entering into the occult, what are you starting to do? What are you doing? Yeah, you're trying to elevate yourself, and not just elevate yourself. Is it wrong necessarily to elevate yourself? Somebody's in poverty. Wrong to elevate yourself out of that? No. So self-elevation, quote-unquote, is not necessarily bad. But when you elevate yourself to sort of that spiritual level or plane where Simon was, we're going to be great, we're going to be God, pride, those kinds of things, you're pushing yourself up, so to speak, and what are you doing to God? You're pulling him down. Do you think that's going to be an issue with God? You start yanking him down and you start pulling yourself up. And that's, as far as an overall point when it comes to the occult, one of the big issues with it. God is belittled and you're putting yourself in the realm of Satan. God is not going to be happy about that. And he warned his people about that in very clear terms throughout the Old Testament many, many times. Anything that you want to add or ask about that before we head over to Isaiah 47? All right, let's take a look at Isaiah 47. We'll start with verse 1 and then read down to verses 12 and 13. And then cite a reference in Acts. Yeah, let's start with verse 1 and then we'll go down to 12 and 13.
Okay. Come down and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon. Sit on the ground without a throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans. For you shall no more be called tender and delicate.
12 and 13.
Stand out your enchantments and the multitude of your sorceries, in which you have labored from your youth. Perhaps you will be able to profit, perhaps you will prevail. You are wearied in the multitude of your counsels. Let now the astrologers and the stargazers and the monthly prognosticators.
Okay.
Stand up and save you from these things. For these things that shall come upon you.
Okay. When you think about Babylon, the people of God or not? Babylon.
No.
All right. They were not. So you have secular people, people who are not the folks of God, also involved with the occult. This takes you back many, many years in time, and they've been involved with it since God said their youth. So people have been seeking help from that kind of realm, from the occult, and it's far from new. You remember in Acts chapter 16, verses 16 through 18, the slave girl brought her master as much gain by soothsaying. So that also would be a first century example. Leviticus 20 and verse 6, I've got at least three more references that I want to run here. Let's take a look at that one next. This is also a reference where God just lays it out very, very plainly. I mean, it's kind of stiff language, but when you start thinking about the occult, what God says about it, what he thinks about it, some passages are really clear, and this is one. Leviticus 20, verse 6. Gary's got it.
And the soul that turneth after such as have familiar spirits and after wizards to go whoring after them, I will even set my face against that soul, and will cut him off from his people.
All right, God says if you're involved with this, you are whoring after them. Spiritual prostitution. As I said, that's tough language, but God said if you become involved with this kind of thing, it's you know, just as you would think about physical adultery, this is that same kind of thing as far as the language that's used. Now, why would somebody become involved with that? The occult. Why turn there? At least a couple reasons spring to my mind.
Interest.
All right, I think there's an interest. People are curious, maybe. All right, I didn't have that one on my list, but I think that would be another great answer. Sometimes people do it for money. That would be the person probably who's offering that service. So people are curious, money. A third reason would be what?
Gain. Earthly gain.
Well, okay, that's kind of the third answer, but let's see if we can add a little bit more to it.
A bad family life.
Okay. All right. I'm going to sum that up as people sometimes want information. They're thinking, if there really is information out there, insider help, then I'm going to turn to that side of life and see if people can really offer some kind of assistance. 2 Chronicles chapter 33, 1-6. 2 Chronicles 33. Who wants to be your helper? All right, Bonnie. 2 Chronicles 33, we'll look at the first six verses.
Manasseh was 12 years old when he began to reign. And he reigned 55 years in Jerusalem. But did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord, like unto the abominations of the heathen, whom the Lord had cast out before the children of Israel. For he built again the high places which Hezekiah his father had broken down, and he reared up altars for Baalim, and made groves, and worshipped all the host of heaven, and served them. Also he built altars in the house of the Lord, whereof the Lord had said, in Jerusalem shall my name be forever. And he built altars for all the host of heaven in the two courts of the house of the Lord. And he caused his children to pass through the fire in the valley of the son of Hinnom. And he observed times, and used enchantments, and used witchcraft, and dealt with the familiar spirit and with wizards. He wrought much evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger.
Okay, this stuff is wholly, entirely, fully opposed to God. And as you go back and you look at Manasseh, what's said about him, his reign, and his involvement in the occult, again, it's not good. God was very, very angry with him. Coupled with that is a reference in Isaiah chapter 8 and verse 19, and I'll read that. And when they shall say unto you, seek unto them that have familiar spirits, and unto the wizards that chirp and that mutter, should not a people seek unto their... Anybody want to guess that last word? Seek unto their God. Should not people seek God? Yes. But where do sometimes people go? Hey, let's check out Madam whoever. Let's check out the tarot cards. Let's check out the palm reader. Let's check out those kinds of things. Not good. And then one more passage. This comes from the book of Leviticus. Leviticus chapter 19 and verse 31. Then we'll see if we can kind of answer a couple questions here. Give you a little something extra to think about. Page is sticky. All right, Leviticus 19:31. Turn ye not unto them that have familiar spirits. Don't turn to them. Don't go to the wizards. Seek them not out to be defiled by them. I am Jehovah your God. God says don't seek them out. If you do, what's that going to do to you? It's going to defile you. That sounds pretty bad. That sounds pretty serious. And God says that is one of the consequences. Now, as you think about this, I think the average Christian would look at it and say, well, okay, witch is out. Tarot cards, yeah, based on what we find, that's probably not something that I want to do. Palm readings, okay, I'm not so comfortable with that. But let me raise this question. What about the horoscope? You don't have to respond right now, but let me just toss this out. for consideration years ago. Getting the paper, you know, I'm 18, 19, 20 years old. I don't remember the exact period of years, but under 25, definitely. I read the horoscope. Not that I really believed in it, but that was something that, you know, that's part of the paper, and I'm going to read that and see what it says and kind of see what happens. The more I began to study the Bible, the more uncomfortable I became with reading the horoscope. I thought, I just, in my mind, don't see a lot of consistency with that in the scriptures. Now, do I put that in the same category as going and visiting a witch? No. I don't think that you can equate the two. However, personally, my decision was that I don't want any part of that stuff. You know, I don't want a satanic Bible as far as the list of books that I have and some other things. I just want to cut myself off from that. And each person is going to have to make their own choice when it comes to that. You might really like the horoscope and read that, quote-unquote, religiously every single day. But when you start going back and seeing what the Bible has to say about this kind of stuff, it is something that you should at least give some consideration to, think it through, pray about it. Another passage that I'll give you, and then we'll have just time to see if you've got a comment or two. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, 21 and 22. Paul said, "You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You can't partake of the table of the Lord and the table of demons. Or do ye provoke the Lord to jealousy? Are we stronger than he?" He's making that point there. If we have that spiritual union with God, we've made the choice as far as being on that side of the fence, the right side of the fence, and stay on that side of the fence. Don't go trotting over to the other side of the fence and becoming involved with some of the things there. Some of the items would, of course, include the occult. Anything that you want to add or ask over what we've said? Bonnie?
When I was a kid, a teenager, the Ouija board was a big thing. And boy, my mom, she was on fire against the Ouija boards. One was not going to be in our house. Boy, I couldn't wait to get over to my friend's house because we always did their Ouija boards out. I don't know.
Well, I think that goes back to either Virginia or Glenda as far as the curiosity factor. Kids are curious about that. And we are, in our society, inundated with the occult. TV, movies, games, internet, stores, people who... I mean, I read you the article about the guy who is doing that kind of thing. I mean, it is all around us. So as a Christian, we need to make some decisions about that. It's something that we should discuss with our kids or our grandkids to let them know that that is out there. The Bible has some very strong things to say about that in the Old Testament. And when you start looking at some of the peripheral items, like the horoscopes and some of the other things, you know, people say, well, it's just for fun and so forth. You might want to take those passages and look at them very, very carefully and make sure that you made a good decision.
It's a gateway into yes. something further.
Sure. And for a lot of people, it has been. Anybody else want to add something? That's where we end it today. Thank you.